So my so thanks first of all, and for the opportunity to talk here and for the nice workshop. I mean, some people have to work to make this workshop happen, and this is one of them. So thanks a lot. So my background is, as Victor just said, in superconductivity and in mesoscopic transport, and I am interested in cold atoms, but the it's kind of a smaller activity in my group. So therefore, in this talk, also you will see that to come up to speed, I will, after an introduction, first talk a topic that is more related to my transport work, and then in the second part of the talk, I will come to density correlations in ultra-cold thermic gases. So again, I mean, this is probably not necessary here in this audience. So at first, you might think noise and fluctuations are kind of a bad thing. But of course, noise and fluctuations contain information about the system. And as the saying by Landauer, the noise is the signal. And what it means is that all physical quantities, like for instance, the current, fluctuate, and so the measurement, if you measure these fluctuations, you obtain informations that go, of course, beyond the information that is contained in the average value of the measurement. And so again, why is this, or to give an example why this can be interesting, say a very old example, Schottky's formula. Schottky investigated currents in vacuum tubes a long time ago. And he realized that the discreteness of the electron charge in the current leads to shot noise. So you can define the noise power by this expression here. Delta I is the deviation of the current from the average current. And then Schottky showed that the zero frequency value of this noise power is given in a vacuum tube, is given by 2 times the electron charge times the average value of the current. And this is due to the random and independent emission of electrons from the cathode. So this means that if you measure both the average current and the noise power, then in this example, you get additional information, namely the charge of the electron. So this is kind of a trivial but nice example that you get additional information by looking at the noise or at fluctuations. Now, to make this idea kind of in a, or this idea, I mean, has of course been around for, say, a long time, 100 years or so, and in quantum optics, people have long talked about counting statistics and photon counting and so on, but in the context of mesoscopic transport, this concept of full counting statistics, that is to look not just at the noise, but at the higher moments of the current, say, was introduced by Levitov and Lisovic and a whole bunch of other people, some of whom are listed here. And the idea is to look not just at the noise, which is the second cumulant, say, of the current, but to look at the higher moment or higher cumulants as well. And so ideally, you would be able to calculate the probability, say if you talk about a current, still about a transport situation, ideally you would be able to calculate the probability P of n, that n electrons have passed a certain cross-section area of your wire, say. And if you had this quantity P of n during a certain time, T0, which is kept fixed. And if you had this probability P of n, then of course you could calculate all the moments, and for instance, the first moment is the average current, and the second moment is related to the noise power, and the higher moments are of course also determined by this P of n. Now, experimentally in transport, Noise power measurements are quite common, so there's a number of groups that do noise power measurements, but to measure these higher moments or accumulants has proven exceedingly difficult. So the first time, to my knowledge, that a third cumulant of a current through time function was measured was in 2003 by Dan Prober's group. This is the first paper related, and a similar and much better in some sense experiment was done by Reznikov later. And there's another set of experiment that is more recent here. So the first one is the group of Klaus Enslin in Zurich, second one Fujisawa et al. So here people look at the full counting statistics of single electron tunneling events, but these are very special experiments in the sense that you have a quantum dot or two quantum dots, and you can actually observe all the electrons tunneling through this dot. And then, of course, it's a rather classical phenomenon here. So you observe the electrons, you measure the time trace, and then once you have the time trace, you can of course calculate all the statistical properties of it.
Anything
that guarantees these cumulants to be finite, as you go to higher and higher cumulant, depending just distribution, you can easily end up infinite cumulants. Yeah, is there anything that guarantees that they are finite? Yeah. I'm not sure, actually. I would be surprised if there was a case where they are not finite, but I don't know of any proof or something. I'm not sure. So these are, as I said, these are very typical experiments, and if I may make a social mark, I think that as you see from this list here, this full counting statistics has been mainly a playground for theoreticians up to now, for this reason. So it's very nice mathematics and so on, and so up to now, no really striking predictions have been made, and since it's exceedingly difficult to measure these high accumulants, only a small number of experimental groups has actually jumped onto this. That is a problem. I think if there was some striking prediction, say that if you can measure h bar to 25 digits or something by looking at high accumulants, then probably people would actually put a lot of effort into measuring these high accumulants. But up to now, this has not happened. This time P0 has to be long enough. Yeah, so you want to have many tunneling events to have happened during that time.
The edge effects are always subleading, aren't they?
Right. And there are also other conditions which I silently used here. For instance, so if you want to write the noise power in this way here, you have to assume stationarity conditions and so on. So now to kind of apply this to an example that I like a lot. Here is a beam splitter. A superconducting beam splitter. So there's a superconductor here on the left-hand side. Current, supercurrent comes in, is divided into two normal arms, normal metal arms, normal one and normal two. And now you can ask, what are the current cross correlations between these two outgoing currents here? Are they positive or negative? And in general, what are the higher cumulants of the currents and the other cross correlations of these currents here? So this is related to a kind of Hanbury-Brown twist type experiment. And I mean, in say, if this was a beam splitter for a beam of incoming thermal bosons, then you would expect that the cross correlations you'd expect the cross correlations to be positive. And if there was an incoming beam of thermal fermions, then you would expect that the cross correlations between the two currents are negative. And now, of course, with the superconductor, you can now ask yourself, okay, is it closer to a beam of bosons or beam of fermions, Cooper pairs? Okay. You can also ask. To answer this question, you can. There are certain kind of limits which you know, and you can take these limits as to get some idea what is happening. So, for instance, Bütiger has shown a long time ago that if you have normal metal multi-terminal structure, so you have n incoming and outgoing leads, normal metal leads, no interactions, then the cross correlations between any two arms are always negative. Now, this does not cover our beam splitter, since here, obviously, we have a superconductor, so it's not a normal system. So we have to do the calculation to figure out what is the sign of the cross correlations here in this case. And to do this, okay, so, we would like to have the probability. Now, this is a bit generalized. You have a probability P of N1 and N2 to count N1 electrons passing through a cross section in lead 1 and N2 electrons passing through a cross section in lead 2 during time T0. And to know this quantity is equivalent to knowing the cumulant generating function, which is the logarithm of the Fourier transform of this probability distribution here. So this function here is the cumulant generating function S of chi1 and chi2. Chi1 and chi2 are called counting fields. And obviously, if you know this S, then you know all the cumulants, because as the name says, it's the cumulant generating function. So for instance, if you want to know the cross correlations of the two currents, you take the second derivative of this function and set chi1 and chi2 equal to 0. And now to calculate this function, we use a formalism that was developed by Yuli Nazarov in 1998 and in later papers. And I don't want to go into this formalism a lot, since it's not the main topic of the talk, but I just want to say this is a method that discretizes your system. You draw your system as a discretized electric circuit. Now, in our case, this means you have to find a discretized version of this beam splitter. And the way we do this is we replace the beam splitter by a set of three tunnel junctions. Each of these boxes here is a tunnel junction, conductance GS, dimensionless conductance GS here. Then there's a central node, and there are two other tunnel junctions which lead to the normal metal leads. And now the method works like this. You write down the Green's functions of the leads. The leads are equilibrium leads, so you know those Green's functions. They are, in this case, 4x4 objects, since we are talking about this superconductor here. And they are Kaldish Green's functions, so it's 2x2 because it's a factor 2 because of Kaldish and a factor 2 because of the superconductor. And so you know the Green's functions of these leads here. You don't know the Green's function of this central island here, but you can determine it by some generalized Kirchhoff law. And then once you know the Green's function of the central dot here, then you can calculate the matrix currents, which are defined by this Green's functions left and right of a circuit element, and then from those the physical currents, and finally the cumulant generating function.
Sorry, can you just relate these quantities to some other if I just think about the Bode gen or something, superconducting or whatever,
right?
Kind of two different long reflection processes.
We'll come to this in one or two slides. So I will say here on this stage I don't have any intuitive picture because the situation is quite non-trivial in the sense that say this formalism takes into account non-equilibrium effect, it takes in account the proximity effect and so on. So in that sense, it takes into account a lot of things, and you can calculate in the end the conductance of the whole structure and, as I said, the cross correlations and so on. But we'll come to your question in a second. So let me just...
I think G's all had the translation though into some components of a scattering matrix.
I'm not sure whether you're thinking of the matrix currents between two between the lead and the central island. Say this is determined by the transmission properties of this circuit element here, and this circuit element here, I took a tunnel junction to make it kind of simple, but you can also take a general kind of a transmissive element, which is defined by its transmission eigenvalues, and a tunnel junction would be a special case of that. I'm not sure whether that's what you're doing. Let's wait for one or two slides, okay?
I view this central, that's the circuit theory somehow. Yeah. I view this central thing plus the two junctions, the three junctions, the one element. But then there's some matrix relating what happens.
But that is a different. I don't think this can be done in general because, as I said, this formalism here involves non-equilibrium effects. So, for instance, here you can calculate the distribution function of the electrons on the central island, and if you apply a voltage and so on, you will find that it's not a Fermi function. It can be it's a non-equilibrium distribution function in general.
Isn't the formalism non-interacting electrons?
It's non-interacting electrons. Yeah.
So I can then just ask about the quantum mechanics of a single.
I don't understand the question, I don't understand the answer, it's a question whether I can repay this three object and the same thing just by one single matrix such that I can just go from left to either up or down. So it's your question, why do I need to have this three gate and the center? And then if your answer that look, I can replace it, maybe, but probably not in this case because there's a degree of freedom, there's a non-Euclidean element at the center that I need to...
Right, yeah, that is what I would say. I'm not sure
if I just take let me think about this physical way, very near equilibrium situation, I just want to inject one electron from, let's say, the upper right.
Yeah.
So then there are two Andreev reflections. Andreev reflect back into the same electrode,
all right.
Or you could have a cross Andreev reflection and come out the other electrode. That some ratio of those two processes can happen. How is that related to your GS and GN?
Well, it's a different. It's a description. It's a description on a different layer of the building, if you want. So say, for instance, if you talk about proximity effect, so the effect that normal metal that is connected to a superconductor also acquires superconducting properties. This you can either say superconducting order parameter is induced in the normal metal, or you can talk about Andreev reflection, which is a description on two layers of the. Of the building,
yeah,
in my book.
Question, because you injected far away from the mean, those are sort of formalism questions. You just inject a light from and what can happen? So you can reflect on that as a whole.
Well, say to yeah, so.
Things would happen far away.
Say what will come out in two slides is that kind of. The sign of the cross correlations is determined whether Cooper pairs are kind of split up and one electron goes into one arm and the other electron goes in the other arm.
That's why I asked.
Yeah, but okay, then maybe let's wait for two slides. Okay. Let's come to the kind of result. So without telling how it's done in detail, I just write down here this acumen generating function now for this situation here. And GS and GN, as I said, the dimensionless conductances of the two of these tunnel junctions. I took these two conductances to be the same. This is just a simplification. It's not necessary. P is this ratio of the conductances over there. And now you see that it's not a very difficult function. On the other hand, it's probably nothing you would have guessed just by, without doing a calculation. And the claim is now that this is the exact expression for this acumen generating function under the assumptions which Leo mentioned before. So it's non-interacting central island here, so no Coulomb blockade effects. And now you can determine the cross correlations by taking derivatives and setting chi1 and chi2 equal to zero. And what you find is this behavior here. So this is the cross correlations divided by the incoming current in the superconductor. And you see that the question was, is it positive or negative? Positive like for bosons or negative like for fermions? And in fact, you see it depends. And it is positive if this ratio here is small or large. And it's negative if the ratio is around 1. And now let's come to the slide that I announced. So if you now go to small ratio of these conductances, and in fact it turns out small and large is the same, this function is has a certain symmetry, and you expand S of chi1 and chi2 in this limit, then you find that you get that is proportional to a sum of three exponentials that are written here. And now one exponential is basically the acumen generating function of one Poissonian process. And the fact that you have a sum of three such terms means you have three statistically independent processes. And you see that the exponents have factors 2 here in the first two terms and no 2 and the sum in the other term here. And now the interpretation is that the first two terms correspond to tunneling events in which a Cooper pair goes from the superconductor to either the left or right outgoing lead. And the last term corresponds to processes in which the Cooper pair splits up and one partner goes to one lead and the other to the other lead. If you now look at the cross correlations, you see that the first two terms don't correlations, and the second term does, and that's why you get the positive cross correlations in this limit here. So in that sense, yeah.
Is it okay to always identify one as kind of conjugate field, the number of electrons,
yeah,
to
one somewhere? Yeah. Chi1 was the Fourier transform variable to N1, so it's exactly this conjugate field. Good. Now, yeah.
And the result of the conductors themselves are small or large, and that's because there's no problem like gain and no interaction.
Yeah. Okay. Now to now for us, so Wolfgang Belzig and me and a grad student that I mentioned in the beginning. The temptation was around to kind of apply this full counting statistics, which we had applied to a number of transport situations, to a situation in ultra-cold gases. Now, I mean, transport is still in its infancy in cold atoms, so the idea here is more to look at the statistics of density fluctuations. And this was proposed, I think, first by in this very nice paper here, Altman, Demler, and looking at probing many body states of ultra-cold atoms. Austin has also done some work in this direction. And say, what do I mean by density fluctuation? Let's look at a graph which I took out of one of the early BCS crossover papers by Rudi Grimm's group. Here he shows in the upper graph there are two, so this is position here. And what is shown here is the density of an atomic cloud measured by absorption. And there are two, so there are two measurements that were taken here of this density profile, and in the lower graph you see the difference of the two measurements. And you see there's unfortunately something missing here. It's a funny color. It's visible on my screen. You see that the density, so the difference shows this clear fluctuations as a function of density. And so the idea is now to describe these density fluctuations. Theoretically, I'm trying a theory for the statistics of these density fluctuations. Now, there has been a number of correlation and noise experiments in the last couple of years. So, following this paper by Altman et al., this is Emanuel Bloch's group here, then Markus Greiner and company. Then slightly different experiment. This is again, this is Simon Esslinger. This is a little bit like the transport experiments that I mentioned in the beginning by Klaus Enslin and Puchisawa. So here you decouple atoms from a cloud and you then really count them. So there's an atom counter, and you count those atoms, and thereby you obtain information about the state of the cloud. And a very recent paper here, this is SMOT, insulator transition in two-dimensional atomic Bose gas. They also show some noise correlation experiments. I have some of these experiments here, but I probably want to skip them. Just here, one graph from Markus Greiner's paper, again, similar to what I showed by Bartenstein et al. Here's the absorption picture of the cloud. And then here, this is a central part of the cloud. And this is the cloud minus its azimuthally averaged value. You have to make this is average, since the density of the cloud changes through the picture. And so by taking the difference of the original picture with this average picture, you find the density fluctuations, and they are shown here. And again, you see, I mean, here these the fluctuations, and the idea is now to kind of divide the system up in bins and to talk about the number statistics of atoms in these bins. Let me maybe jump over this. We can look at them in the end if anybody's interested. Our idea was to apply this to particularly look at the BC-BCS crossover and to calculate, as I said, the counting statistics of the atom number in a bin of such a cloud. Again, here is the density system divided up into bins, here one-dimensional bins. They are really three-dimensional. And the assumption is there's a number n total of atoms in the cloud. And this is assumed to be much larger than the number of atoms in the bin. And this, again, is assumed to be much larger than one. So the idea is that the bin size is much larger than the particle-particle distance cubed. Okay, now this is a bit repetitive. For counting statistics, again, this is the quantity which we want to find. And so this the probability P of n, to have n atoms in such a bin. And again, what we can calculate equivalently is the cumulant shadowing function and the cumulants to make this specific are defined by this relation here. So you write this function as a series, and then CR is the rth cumulant. So the first cumulant is the average number of particles, the second cumulant the variance, and so on. Now, as I said, we would like to apply this idea to the BC-BCS crossover, and there are many experts here in the audience that know much more about the crossover than I do. But what this slide here shows that of course in cold atom systems you can actually, in contrast to a supernatant system, you can actually go through this crossover, because by varying a magnetic field and making use of Feshbach resonances, you can change the interactions between the fermions in such a way that you can go from the say from a BEC limit of tightly bound pairs to a BCS limit of large pairs much larger than the particle-particle distance. But now the question is, what description do we take to describe this crossover? And we take a rather simple-minded description here, namely the mean field BCS wave function, which is written here. So this BCS wave function was, of course, invented by BCS to describe ordinary superconductors, but it was later argued by Eagles and Tony Leggett, among others, that this wave function can also be used to describe the full crossover approximately. The point is, in your superconductivity book, you find a certain expression for the coefficients UK and VK here. They are found by a variational approach. VK squared is 1 minus UK squared is given by this expression here. But if you now write down the self-consistency equations for the order parameter delta and for the chemical potential, these are the two self-consistency conditions, then it turns out that you can also describe the limit of tightly bound pairs. So in the BCS limit, the VK squared, this function here, looks a bit like a smeared Fermi function. And in the limit of tightly bound pairs, it is almost flat. I did not bring a picture of VK squared, unfortunately. Okay, these are the self-consistency conditions, and now you have to solve them to determine delta and U as a function of the interaction of the atoms, and this is shown here. So you the interaction of the atoms is parameterized by their scattering length A, so 1 over KFA, and we now plot both delta over EF and mu over EF as a function of this parameter here, minus 1 over KFA in basically. In fact, we do it as minus 1 over KFA minus the same value at mu equal to 0. And then, so if this parameter here is much less than 1, so the left side of the two graphs, this corresponds to the BC limit, and if it's much bigger than 1, this corresponds to the BCS limit. And this you can, the kinetic potential. Yes, that is the case of the tightly bound pairs. Yeah. So if you look here first at the delta over EF, so, what you see that the BCS limit is here. So let's just look at the three-dimensional case for simplicity. In the three-dimensional case, delta is exponentially small in this. In minus this quantity here, so that's this part here, and mu is equal to the Fermi energy here. That is the BCS case. And if you go to the BC case, then mu is equal to the binding energy of the now tightly bound pairs, and delta increases.
Let's say that the Fermi energy is the Fermi energy of the Fermi gas in the absence of interactions, while mu is the chemical potential of the whole system counted at from the bottom of the band of the turbulence.
Okay.
What is your delta in the BEC limit? Is it delta, the gap? What is the value of delta in the BEC limit?
What do you mean? What is the value of delta?
But
what is?
No, my question is that in the BCS limit, what is delta? We know.
Delta is the gap. Yeah.
It's just the gap.
Yeah.
And then what people had done spectroscopically in England, they were measuring delta. Of course, the BCS limit has not been achieved, but they were measuring in the strong interacting regime. And then in the BEC regime. And in the BEC regime, it also goes to the binding energy of a molecule of this type of alpha. Is it the same in your calculation?
I don't think delta is the binding energy of molecules in the BEC regime. Delta saturates, well, delta is controlled by the density of particles in the BEC regime.
It depends how we define delta.
Well, delta is defined here, is defined uniquely by this self-consistency condition here.
So it's not delta in the
it's not
delta that we're measuring.
So if you look at the
delta is defined as what is every interaction times the pair field.
If the pair field saturates as a total number of particles, they'll also saturate some number.
But this is different delta compared to what people call delta in the
DEC
limit when they were measuring delta.
It's not. It's the chemical potential that reduces the binding energy.
Right.
The type of the
pipeline. Yeah, this is.
They are related because delta, the excitation, a single particle excitation, is given by delta all the parameter square plus mu square root in the field theory.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay.
In the quantum case, which you display over there, do you get in the BCS limit, do you get this famous Miyake formula that the delta is not exponentially small, but so the power of small or something compared to the
I don't know the Miyake formula, and I must say, so I did not look at the these curves in much detail. It looks a bit like what you say here on this graph, but I cannot be sure. So you say delta should vanish here.
For the S-wave pairing in the 2D case, the transition temperature and delta, they are not exponentially dependent on the interaction parameter, but the dependence is power law. And it has been obtained by people who were studying here in three fields, let's say 25 years ago.
Different from 3D. Yeah. It's certainly different, as you can also see here, but I'm not sure what the answer is to your question. So back to the counting statistics. Now we take this wave function and okay, as I said, it's a simple-minded description. It's a mean field wave function. The k states are decoupled, and therefore you can. You can calculate the contribution of each k state separately. So e to the minus s k of chi is given by this expression here. So this is the sum of the. Of the operators nk up and n minus k down, and you find by a very easy calculation that you get this expression here. And now combining all states, you get this expression here. And now this is a general result for this wave function. So if you accept this wave function as a description of the crossover region, then this function here should contain the information about the counting statistics. I should say that this this looks like a closed expression, but of course it is this vk squared here, as we know, contains delta and mu. So it's not a closed expression in that sense. You have to combine this expression with the self-consistency conditions, and which give you delta and mu, and you plug in delta and mu here in this vk squared. Now, in two dimensions, you can actually evaluate this this integral here analytically because of the constant density of states, and you get this expression listed up here. And in 3D, we did not manage to find an analytical expression, so you have to evaluate the function numerically. Okay, now let's look at the limits. At the limiting cases, in the BC regime, so as a test, so to speak, of this formula, in the BC case, as we saw before, mu over EF is much less than minus one, vk squared is much less than one. If you evaluate this function s of chi, you find this expression here. So this is the expression of for a Poissonian statistics of strongly bound pairs. And this is quite nice because if you compare this directly with, say, with a free condensate, so we take non-interacting bosons, not quite canonical because that does not work, of course, but if you now take a non-interacting bosons and you look at the ground state, so a zero dagger to the total number of particles, and you divide now this Bose operators ak into a bin part and an outside part, so bk is the bin part of the boson, and CK is the part that belongs to the rest of the volume. And you define the bin number operator by this expression here. You can then calculate the function S of chi directly. You find this expression here. And in the limit that the bin volume is much less than V, you find this expression here, which is this Poissonian expression, which we just had on the last transparency. The point is that there are factors two here, which are not visible here, because here we talk about bosons, and in the last transparency we talked about counting fermions. So that seems to agree nicely. Now, for the other limiting case is, of course, the BCS regime. Here you find this expression for the Kuhlmann generating function S of chi. Remember that the first derivative of S at chi equal to 0 gives you the mean value. So this first term here always gives you the mean value of particles n prime. And the second part here gives the fluctuation. So in this case, we find that there are fluctuations, but they are suppressed by the small parameter delta over EF in the BCS regime. D is the dimension here. D is 3 or 2. We can compare this now for the to the free Fermi gas. I mean, for the free Fermi gas, we can easily evaluate this function also. And in the free Fermi gas, you find that you get this expression here. So it's a Gaussian distribution, and the prefactor of this chi squared term here is temperature over EF. So in the free Fermi gas, you get that the variance of the particle number vanishes for temperature going to zero. This was also discussed in a recent paper by Yvan Castin here. And here in our case, as I said, we have this small but visible fluctuating contribution here. Now these were the two limits. Now you can look at the two at the full range of parameters here. And I should say that this is kind of debatable, and we've been criticized for using this mean field BCS wave function to describe the transition region, because it is known that this mean field wave function works well for the two limits, but in the intermediate range, it's questionable. So at zero temperature, maybe it still works half okay, depending on the quantity that you look at.
What many people say. Yeah. Many people say that the mean field approach for the strongly interacting part, of course, BCS and BEC we know.
Yeah.
But in the strongly interacting part, the mean field approach is good at zero temperature, but maybe not good at a finite temperature. I could never understand why. And what means finite temperature, zero temperature? This is all more or less like praying in a church. Let's use the mean field regime. It's perhaps not bad.
Well, as I said, we are simple-minded. I would love to take some more sophisticated formalism and also calculate the counting statistics there. I mean, that is something we can talk about. Yeah. But so this is what we've done. So if you, sorry?
Oh, you want to answer? Please do it.
I think historically, it's just not clear whether how to reduce. I think even Tony himself wasn't quite clear how to reduce at fire temperature. And then I think the research written paper first showed that there's a huge difference between the immediate theory at fire temperature and the fluctuations. So I think that's why it's so astounding that the normalization that he found in the EEC side was huge. And the nuclear scale go up like this, and then you will normalize to something more than 200%. But then now, the surprising thing, that at the strong interacting region with the resonance, then somehow then the realization is rather small. Exactly why, I don't think it's also known. It's really a calculation. But that is a region that it is a strong interacting system, and then the typical region to be very large, but somehow, for some reason, it doesn't seem to be, the migration doesn't seem to be that dramatic. I don't think it's known. Okay.
But But here I don't talk about fine temperature, mind. Yeah, okay. But it's all zero temperature. But the question was whether it's a good description in the intermediate range, and I think that is what Jora was also criticizing. Yeah, yeah.
Because I have no doubt that in the BCS limit it's okay. About the molecular regime, the DC limit, I have my own reservations about what people in condensed metaphysics do. Actually, they go wrong, but it's okay.
Jora, you are also condensed metaphysics.
I'm general. And then, but you know, are there Monte Carlo calculations in this strongly interacting regime that we can compare with the mean field calculations or not?
I don't know. Are there Monte Carlo calculations?
No, well, I'm just saying that if I use the mean field regime in the strongly interacting part, where fluctuations are strong, in order to make sure that I am doing something reasonable, at least at zero temperature, it would be nice to compare with good Monte Carlo calculations.
There are a lot of them, actually. I mean, not on the counting statistics, but on some
other. No. I'm just asking not about the counting statistics, about something else.
Yeah, there are a lot of, actually, Monte Carlo results, actually, at the unitarity regime to calculate thermodynamic properties. And what they do find, actually, is that essentially at the unitarity, you only have one scale parameter, the density.
Yeah, this we know very well.
Okay, then
even without Monte Carlo.
It's a parameter, universal parameter times Kf to some power. And then you do Monte Carlo, and then how that parameter changes. And it's
the collection is the mean field value, the alpha, I don't know, 10-15% or so. And I also recall that there's a disagreement between Monte Carlo calculation. I don't know when it's settled. All the Monte Carlo calculation, a lot of my calculations, so-called is T0 calculates coefficient details.
Yes,
they disagree
with each other, these Monte Carlo calculations.
I think it's not converging yet.
And I was just wondering, if I compare Monte Carlo calculations for this beta or for the chemical potential in the at unitarity, how do these results compare with the mean field results?
At zero temperature, it's all plus or minus 20%.
Okay, so this is what we've done. We've used this mean field calculation to calculate, in this case here, the second cumulant. And because we have the full cumulant function, so you can take any cumulant now. And what you see is, let's again look at the three-dimensional case, say that that the C2 is strongly suppressed in the BCS limit. No wonder, because as we discussed before, I mean, if you go to free fermions, it's suppressed completely to zero. Here, C2 is normalized to the mean value of particles. If you multiply by EF over delta, you get this curve here. So this is the same information, only plotted differently. And now you see this red curve here goes to a finite value in the BCS regime, and this finite value we know exactly. So delta over EF turns out to be 4C2 over pi n bar d. D is the dimension. So that means if you could determine C2, you would have a measure of delta also. Here's the third cumulant. Again, it also vanishes rapidly. I don't have much to say about the third cumulant. This is a little bit like what I said in the beginning. I mean, you can now, of course, calculate all the cumulants and so on, but unless you have something non-trivial to say about these higher cumulants, it's a little bit hard to actually motivate people to make an effort to look for these higher cumulants. But in principle, the information is there, so if anybody needs the higher cumulants, then they are contained in this general expression. I will go back to the 1 hour talk schedule. We've had many talks that lasted 2 hours, so 1 hour is over, so that's why I stop here and stop by saying that Foucault statistics in principle gives you additional information on many body systems, other way to probe many body systems. And in the first part of the talk, I studied a beam splitter geometry, a hybrid beam splitter superconductor into two normal metal leads. And in the second part, I looked at the Kulkarni statistics of fermionic atoms at the BC-PCS crossover. And I mean, I have many open questions here myself, and so of course it would be nice to have better models for the crossover regime and maybe compare them to these mean field results. One would like to know, of course, finite temperature effects there. The question that Jason was alluding to comes in. So is this mean field theory at all credible at finite temperatures?
I haven't gotten the message that you try to tell us at the end. So are you suggesting that? So the question: what light has been shed by looking these counting statistics for the BC-BCS crossover? Are you saying that the answer is consistent with the crossover theory? What is the message?
No. You could. I think the message is that by measuring, so by looking at the density fluctuations, you could measure delta and mu in some sense. Well, here this curve here shows, for instance, the C2 as a function of our interaction here. This is minus 1 over Kf, KFA here. So if you now if you were able to measure the density fluctuations, then you could that is the simple example here. So if you are here on the BC side, there is this link between delta and C2. So if you can measure C2, then you know delta.
That is true only within the field, right?
Right.
In general,
right.
Christo,
yeah.
Some time ago, several people claimed and made derivations that for a narrow resonance, you can treat this BCS-BC crossover in the approach of weakly interacting gas, and it works, because narrow resonance means that actually a small fraction of particles are resonance physically. Yes. And Victor Burari, sitting over there, is one of such people. Did you try to handle the narrow resonance case for your situation where the weakly interacting gas approach is supposed to work?
No, we did not, but I would be interested to talk to you about it.
I think in the narrow resonance case, weakly theory simply works. So whether the amounts to these curves will work, that you have to relabel parameters.
Right.
That's the question I have been wondering. So the mean field theory works in what temperature range that you're referring to? Is it C=0 or am I talking about C=0? Actually, I was wondering, can you summarize what's the difficulties technically if I want to move up to higher temperatures or the narrow reference? Well, it's the same difficulty that you would get to do.
In other words, that puts fluctuations induced by temperature. So when you get fluctuations for some reason,
Maybe I should also say that we've had some very interesting discussions with Austin, also who first wrote to Christian Scholl, the grad student, a long time ago, that there's a question about, say he had theoretical arguments that the variance of such a system should actually vanish in the thermodynamic limit, right? And the point is here, I think, that, my opinion, but he can comment on it, is that if you talk about, this means the bins should not be too large. I mean, obviously, if you look at the whole system, then there's no variance in the particle number. The variance vanishes, zero. But in a bin of finite size, you can have fluctuations of the particle number, obviously, and that's what we think is described here by this theory.
What's the effect of the shock? Can you comment on that?
We have not looked at it, but in principle, say, this
the effect of the trap usually is that many more people write papers. People construct general theory, and then there is a bunch of guys jumping around and adjusting this theory in the case of a trap. That's what my answer is.
okay, let me consider your comment. So, for this group too, jumping around, the question, what would they say, like, begin to have a
but you, you could include the effect of the trap here in this formula, but we've not done it.
Just a comment. I mean, there's this Lovato formula for counting statistics in endoscopic systems, which I think we've got a very simple derivation for, which I think can be easily adopted to questions of noise within a trap where particle number is conserved, and you can ask about the noise of number of particles inside one part of the trap with respect to the other.
Okay.
It's neat formalism.
Okay.
No more questions?
Thank you.